This is edition number 2017 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 15th of May, 2026. Hello, you're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 14th of May, 2026. My name is John Hoyle, and my fellow readers are
Pauline Andrews
and Chris Lodes.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5:05 a.m. and will set at about 8:55 p.m. The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes an experienced cowgirl who missed out on farming, some interesting Korean tea facts, some record-breaking creatures in the natural world, and a look at the friends and foe among the smaller critters who get close to us.
But we begin with the main news items, which include results of the local elections in Norfolk, the sentencing of a violent trio of young people who almost killed another young man, fraud, vandalism, and the good news about a slow mollusk and its association with the market town of Aylsham. Let's start with those lead stories.
Mr. Lowe's Great Yarmouth First took a clean sweep of 9 seats in the town, leaving Reform 3 seats short of a majority at County Hall. The result means the start of frenzied horse trading between parties to see who can create a coalition to take control. Reform may find themselves short of allies, particularly given the bitter feud with Yarmouth First and other parties who are greatly opposed to their policies. Mr. Farage's party needed 43 out of the 84 seats to have overall power, but won 40. The Lib Dems are now the second biggest party with 13 seats. The Greens won 12, the Tories got 8, and Labour and Independent got 1 each. County Hall has been under Conservative control, who previously had 50 councillors. Turnout across Norfolk was higher than expected, with some areas above 50%. Mr. Lowe said, "We will do what we were elected to do, put Great Yarmouth first." The day had started with Mr. Farage predicting his party will take control at County Hall with an extraordinary margin. He said, "Forget left-right. There's no more left-right. It's gone. It's finished." What you'll see is the same pattern repeated across the south. We will win Essex by an extraordinary margin and Norfolk by an extraordinary margin. Tory K. Mason Billig, who has been county council leader, held on to her seat. She said, "Reform has made promises which have mostly come from Nigel Farage. I don't think we can trust Reform. I'm going to be there to hold them to account. The Conservatives are on the rise, and we will be back." Asked specifically about a possible coalition with Reform, she said, "I don't think so. I'll be talking to my group tomorrow and looking at what our options might be." Great Yarmouth First's Barry Gravenal, who ousted long-standing Conservative Graham Plant, said, "We expected it to go well, but this well, no. We've been saying on the doorsteps is that we're going to be the pebble that starts the avalanche." But Reform's rise will also be hampered by the success of the Lib Dems, particularly in North Norfolk. They won 7 of the 10 seats in the district. Tim Adams, leader of the North Norfolk District Council, won in Cromer. He said, "It's also a victory for level-headed governance, and we have all got to work to do that at the County Council." The Labour Party lost all of their County Council seats, although there was a surprise win in Heatherset for their candidate Ben Weston. In West Norfolk, Reform took 12 of its 14 county council divisions. Those who succumbed included veteran Conservative county councillors Brian Long, Leslie Bambridge and Martin Storey. Norwich Greens took 10 of the city's 13 county council divisions. Helena Weisskopf, one of the newly elected Green councillors, said, "We won by a really wide margin, which we weren't expecting." In Breckland, Reform claimed 11 of the 12 county council divisions in the district. Daniel Burcham was voted in for Attleborough, and among those he beat was Conservative Talia Taylor. Conservative Alison Webb won Dereham, North and Scarning division. Great Yarmouth First also won the Caister South by-election on the Great Yarmouth Borough Council, marking a momentous day for the party, which was only officially registered in March.
A trio nearly tortured a man to death after whipping and scalding him in a brutal and prolonged attack. The shocking incident was discovered when police received a call from a member of the public in North Walsham, saying they could hear a man groaning in pain somewhere on Cherry Tree Lane. Officers arrived to find a man lying in the road, covered in blood, with significant injuries to his face, head, arm and back. He also suffered severe scalds and had a dog lead wrapped around his body, which investigators believe was used to whip him and tie him to a chair during the attack. The man, who was in his 20s, was taken to hospital in critical condition and was unable to tell officers who he was or what had happened during the attack on September the 27th, 2025. He spent 2 months recovering in hospital, including time in a specialist burns unit. Detectives later identified a link to 23-year-old Billy Galley, who lived just minutes away from where the man was found. Galley was arrested at her home, along with Taylor Richardson, 18, of Fresher Mews, Norwich, and Kane Papp Pettit, 19, of Victoria Road, Great Yarmouth. All three were charged and initially denied the allegations, before later changing their pleas. They were sentenced at King's Lynn Crown Court on Monday. Galley of Laundry Loke, North Walsham, was jailed for 12 years with an additional 5 years on extended licence after admitting inflicting GBH with intent. Richardson was sentenced to 3 years and 2 months in a Young Offenders Institute, and Pap Pettit received 2 years and 8 months after both admitted GBH without intent. Judge Andrew Shaw, sentencing Galley, said, "I cannot understand how any human being, let alone one as young as you, could effectively torture another being to the point they almost lost their life. But for the intervention of experienced, talented medical professionals, he would have lost his life. He would have been tortured to death by you." In a personal statement read to the court, the victim explained how the attack still affects him. "Although I have recovered well in some ways, I continue to suffer physical pain. My shoulders and back are still painful, my wrists remain sore, and I experience occasional headaches. But the mental impact of the incident has been severe. I experience frequent flashbacks and nightmares about what happened. I struggle to leave my house and I will not go out alone. I find myself thinking about the incident all the time, and it has affected my ability to sleep. I often lie awake, replaying what happened. My physical injuries, psychological trauma and loss of trust have changed how I live my life. I am not the same person I was before this happened, and I am unsure how long it will take for me to feel safe again."
A £5,000 reward is still being offered after vandals attacked garden roses at a Norfolk estate after the police closed their investigation. Mannington Hall Estate offered the hefty monetary reward after there were several incidents of vandalism, with acts including the deliberate destruction of the garden roses. The reward was for any information that leads directly to the arrest and conviction of those responsible, the estate had said. Norfolk Police had launched an investigation into the incidents, which occurred in April, but it has now confirmed that the case has been closed. A spokeswoman for the force said, "All lines of inquiry have been exhausted and the case has been closed. We would always review any new information provided to us." However, a spokeswoman for the estate had said the £5,000 reward remains on offer. She said, "We understand the police investigation is closed, but that doesn't mean that the investigation won't be reopened if significant new information is forthcoming. The reward, therefore, remains on offer." The estate's rose collection was planted in the 1980s and included rambling, shrub and climbing varieties.
St John's Ambulance volunteers will now respond to 999 calls in an emergency co-responding pilot scheme. The six-month project launched in Norfolk on May the 1st as part of a partnership with East of England Ambulance Service, NHS Trust EEAST, volunteers will be dispatched to emergency scenes to begin clinical assessment and deliver life-saving care before ambulance crews arrive. Tom Willis, head of clinical standards for St John's Ambulance, said, "This pilot is about getting professional volunteers and life-saving equipment to patients when those first few minutes really matter. By working in partnership with the NHS, our co-responders will use their skills and knowledge to provide early assessment and intervention, support patients in their own communities, and help reduce pressure on ambulance services. Volunteers are trained to handle emergencies, including cardiac arrests, strokes, serious bleeding, and road traffic collisions. They will operate blue light vehicles equipped with defibrillators, oxygen, airway management tools, and emergency medicines. The service is free for the NHS and relies on donations, philanthropy, and support from partner organisations."
Vandals who smashed up part of an abandoned building in a North Norfolk village have sparked a police hunt. The structure in Hall Road, Gimmingham, was targeted between 4:30 p.m. and 5 p.m. on Sunday, April the 26th. Several doors and windows were smashed, and officers are now investigating the damage. The force is urging anyone who may have any information about the vandalism or saw anything suspicious in the area during this time to get in touch using crime reference 36/29527/26.
A leading conservationist will discuss the impact of deer on agriculture during a free farmers' breakfast meeting next month. The latest Aylsham Agricultural Breakfast, organised by Norfolk-based accountancy firm Lovewell Blake, takes place on June the 4th at Young's Park in Aylsham. Guest speaker Dee Dyer from Norfolk Farming and Wildlife Advisory Group, FWAG, will discuss her organisation's deer and wild venison strategy. Born and raised in Zimbabwe, she studied animal science at Reading University before her passion for conservation and animal welfare led to a career lecturing in environmental conservation and countryside management. She was also one of the founding members of Watatunga Wildlife Reserve near King's Lynn. The meeting will also hear a topical update for the farming sector from Lovewell Blake, agricultural partner Chris Salt, as well as an overview of pensions and markets, including the impact of the Iran war, from financial advisor Chris Egmore. The event from 8:30 a.m. to 10:15 a.m. on June the 4th is free to attend, but places must be booked in advance at www.lovewell-blake.co.uk/events. A beach ramp has been reopened months after it was destroyed by a storm. North Norfolk District Council temporarily closed the ramp at Haysborough after Storm Goretti swept rain across the region in January. At the time, a spokesman for the council said, "The council is monitoring the weather forecast over the winter period and will assess when we are able to recut the ramp." It came after a warning was issued the same week about quicksand near the ramp. Haysborough Coast Watch had warned that areas of very soft sand were developing in the area, and the council urged people to stay away from the affected place. A spokesman for the district council has now confirmed that the repair work has been completed and there is access to the beach via the ramp. The ramp has been closed for several winters in a row due to storm tides, heavy rain and high winds, making it unsafe. Haysborough has long been the subject of concerns about erosion. In the last 20 years, about 100 metres of land have been lost in parts of the village.
The starting pistol has fired on a heritage trail that is dedicated to a slow-moving creature that calls its shell its home. Aylsham is soon to become home to a new heritage trail, comprising of 21 different snails, in a bid to combine history, culture and technology in an interactive experience. Each snail character will identify key historical features of the town, with a mixture of metalwork, woodwork and stone carvings by Tusa Wilson. And for the centrepiece of the trail, there will be a giant version of a gastropod painted by the town's own Mick Richardson. Snails are a key symbol for the town, with Aylsham embedded in the slow food movement, as well as it being the only sitter-slow town in England, both of which have the mollusk as a badge. Jane Andrew, learning officer at the Aylsham Heritage Centre, is leading the project and said she had been planning this idea for years. "I am beyond excited," she said. The trail is designed to guide visitors through the town, encourage them to explore and learn more about what has shaped Aylsham over centuries. Plans have been submitted to Broadland Council for some plaques of the snails on listed buildings in the town, including the Black Boys Hotel and the Watermill. In a statement, it said, "The intention of the project is to create an interactive experience that combines history, culture and technology in a family-friendly way." The launch of the trail will coincide with the Great Aylsham Snail Race at the beginning of August. The event, described as the slowest and silliest race, is held annually as people come to watch live snails compete for the Lettuce Pot Trophy. The project is a collaboration between the Heritage Centre, the Town Council and Sitterslow.
Our next few news stories involve, in turn, a historic hall, a medieval bridge, an old helicopter and the Wherry Yacht Charter.
Staff at an historic hall in North Norfolk were delighted after it was featured in a Channel 5 show. Actors Samuel West of All Creatures Great and Small and his friend Adrian Edmondson, who is known for The Young Ones, travelled the county for their show Sam and Aid Go Birding. After a day of bird spotting, the pair stayed at Marsh Lane Cottage on the grounds of Wiveton Hall, near Clye, next to the sea. They enjoyed a meal and remarked on how lovely the cottage was. In the episode, West went on an early morning hunt for owls around the hall, which led him to meet its owner, Desmond McCarthy. The hall is a Jacobean manor house dating back to 1652, which has a cafe and garden that visitors can go to, as well as various events throughout the year. A spokeswoman for Wiveton Hall said, "We're delighted to have him and aide stay at Marsh Lane Cottage while they explored the coastline." She also confirmed the hall has a number of inquiries and a few holiday cottage bookings since the episode was released. After staying at the cottage, the pair spent the rest of their time around Clye after driving along the A149, which West titled the Silk Road of Birding. And Clye Next the Sea has been included in a roundup by the Telegraph of the country's most beautiful spots. The village was labelled as the best place for bird watching and won praise for the views on offer. Clye and neighbouring Blakeney, they're only 1.5 miles apart, are the North Norfolk coast and it's most iconic, the publication said. Flinty buildings line comely little streets while the world beyond melts into salt marsh, reed beds and fathomless skies. Clye is a lovely place to mooch, admire the 18th century windmill and pop into the traditional smokehouse, the deli, crab pot, second-hand books and the pottery workshop.
Potterheim Parish Council has backed a package of measures aimed at tackling long-standing concerns about speeding, parking and pedestrian safety on the village's medieval bridge. Councillors agreed to call for a 15-mile-per-hour speed limit over the bridge, a signal-activated pedestrian crossing and, if funding ever allows, renewed support for a dedicated pedestrian bridge. The bridge, a Grade 2 listed structure over the River Thurn, is one of the most recognisable landmarks on the Norfolk Broads, but it has long been a flashpoint for safety concerns. Speed monitoring on Bridge Road has previously recorded thousands of vehicles exceeding the limit over a single fortnight, while parked cars near the Folgate Inn have repeatedly forced pedestrians into the road. The council also wants double yellow lines added outside Broadland House and the Folgate Pub, both described as persistent pinch points where parked cars force pedestrians into the road. The proposals agreed at the January Parish Council meeting were submitted to Norfolk County Council's Highways Project Team after a final round of email consultation among councillors. This followed a feasibility study. The study will also recommend improved signage at the A1062 junction, directing drivers towards the A149, rather than using Bridge Road as a cut-through. The Parish Council ran a community survey in spring 2023. Of 192 responses, 56% favoured keeping the bridge open, but with weight restrictions and improved pedestrian safety. 33% wanted permanent closure and pedestrianisation, and just 11% wanted the bridge left fully open with no changes. In that same year, a sinkhole opened up near the bridge, forcing a temporary road closure and diverting traffic via the A149 bypass. While the bridge was eventually repaired by the County Council, local businesses had reported a notable drop in trade while it was closed. Norfolk County Council has been contacted for comment.
The City of Norwich Aviation Museum has acquired a Westland Wessex helicopter from the Museum of Wales to help tell the story of a tragic air-sea rescue from RAF Coltishall near Wroxham. Although the aircraft was never used in action, it is an example of the kind that was and played a role in its development. The helicopter was built around 1958-59 and was used for trials. It is one of the oldest of the pre-production models and was the fifth ever model built. Originally assigned to the Royal Navy, it spent time with the RAF but was never used as a squadron aircraft. It was used to develop later models of the Wessex and is believed it assisted in developing autopilot systems. Steve Day, 56, a trustee at the museum, said, "To restore it and display it to be able to tell the story to the public, that is the important thing. Our plan is to restore it, but there are not many spares. It will take about 5 years. It will sit on the field with our Whirlwind to tell the story of air-sea rescue in Norfolk. The Westland Wessex lies in the Cold War period, when it was in service with the Royal Navy from 1961. Its original use was in anti-submarine operations, but it was also used for search and rescue and as a general workhorse aircraft. The Wessex was one of the first turbine-powered helicopters and had powerful engines which increased its payload while lowering noise and vibration. In 1988, the Royal Navy replaced the Wessex with the Sea King. Search and rescue helicopters were once based at RAF Coltishall. On Thursday, June the 22nd, 1967, the Whirlwind helicopter XJ414 was heading back from an exercise at Pakefield near Lowestoft when a rotor blade became detached, leading to the craft plunging into the sea 160 yards off Caister Beach. The three crewmen killed were 47-year-old pilot Flight Lieutenant Archie Gavin, the commanding officer of the search and rescue D flight at RAF Coltishall, and who had been a Battle of Britain Spitfire pilot, Flight Lieutenant Gil Pink and Master Navigator Harry Crossman. RAF Coltishall was one of the longest commissioned airfields in the UK until it closed in 2006. The site played a crucial role during the Second World War as a fighter base. The Wherry Yacht Charter is hosting two art events to celebrate the Norfolk Wherry's role in the region's artistic heritage. It is said the boats have been the artistic soul of the Broads, frequently depicted in landscapes by artists such as John Crome and John Sell Cotman. The Norwich School artists began capturing the black-sailed wherries against vibrant marshlands in the early 19th century, highlighting their importance in Norfolk life. The 20th century saw white-sailed leisure wherries favoured by artists like Leslie L. H. Moore, contributing to the wherries' artistic legacy. Today, the few remaining wherries are cherished by artists, sustaining a 200-year legacy of beauty on the water. Wherry Yacht Charter is welcoming back Sue Haywood for an exhibition at Howe Hill, running from May the 23rd to May the 25th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. daily. Sue, a Norfolk-based multimedia artist, is renowned for her work inspired by the Norfolk landscape. Attendees will have the chance to view and purchase various pieces. Sue is also offering a unique piece as a prize to one fortunate exhibition attendee with free entrance to the draw. For those wanting a more hands-on experience, there's an opportunity to join a plein air sketching workshop led by Norfolk artist Emily Bird on June the 22nd. Emily, known for her work capturing the Norfolk coast and countryside, will conduct the workshop on the staith at Howe Hill, overlooking the flagship wherry Hathor. The event starts at 4:30 p.m. with tea and cake. Spaces are limited to 12 at £20 per person. Being a day after Father's Day, this would be a unique gift for budding artists. Booking is essential at wherryyachtcharter.org. You're listening to edition number 2017 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 15th of May 2026. Still to come, there are items about fundraising, community matters and planning considerations, and of course the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, letters to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Peter Sherwood of Sir William's Lane, Aylsham, writes, "We're encouraged to believe that the National Trust are the guardians of our landscape and built environment. Is this still the case? Anyone visiting the Muddy Boots Cafe on the Blickling Estate might question this. We can perhaps understand the rationale for reproducing and preserving a 60s motorway cafe servery, after all, part of history. But should we place this in a 17th century preserved farm building to replace an existing charming and characterful period structure? No doubt the National Trust will have a plausible reason, hygiene, efficiency, etc. Is it for this that members and public lay out their hard-earned cash?
As a one-time born-again biker, I feel qualified to comment on the timely recent article where motorcyclists are urged to refresh their skills. Today, for many of us, motorcycling is a summertime hobby, and the winter layoff means come Easter we are a bit rusty, though old summertime memories can make us think different. All that said, why not book a cross-check ride with the IAM or ROSPA? I've been a member of Norfolk Advanced Motorcyclist for 30 years and guarantee a couple of hours with a NAM, a NAM observer will make for a much better summer, and for born-agains, the ride out and up-to-date advice is worth its weight in gold. This letter was written by Paul Milner from Sheringham. And now to this week's obituaries.
Geraldine Mary Staines, Jerry, née Webster, formerly Bowen, passed away aged 83 in the loving care of Millbridge Nursing Home, Heacham, peacefully and pain-free. Born in Cromer to Jack and Molly, deceased, sister of Tony, deceased, married to Mike until his death in 1986, and Graham until his death in 2023. Loved mother of Kay, Paul, deceased, and Neil, Nan, mother-in-law, aunt and sister-in-law. A celebration of Jerry's life will be held at Cromer Crematorian Chapel on Friday, May the 29th, 2026 at 10:30 a.m, followed by a burial at Cromer Town Cemetery. Immediate family flowers only, please. Donations may be left at the service, and they'll be equally divided between the Mardler Talking Newspaper and Cromer RNLI. Please feel free to wear something bright and colourful as per Jerry's wishes. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone 01263 512 427.
And now some articles about local events and establishments to tempt you out and about in your area.
The Stalham Fringe Festival of Music and Dance, organised by the Stalham Area Business Forum, will take place on May the 17th. The event features local performers with musicians and dancers taking over the High Street and two indoor venues, St Mary's Church and the Town Hall. The High Street will be closed from 10 a.m. to make way for more than 40 stalls, offering a range of food, drink and craft items. The free entertainment kicks off at 11 a.m. and will run all day. Performers include the Holt Ridge Morris Dancers, the Pan Afro Band and the Scratch Band, among others. Festival goers can also enjoy the sounds of the street organ Lucy and the Black Hat Saxophone Quartet. There will be free parking available at Stalham High School, Stalham Staith Surgery and Tesco's for up to 3 hours. The festival promises 6 hours of entertainment with something for everyone to enjoy in a traffic-free space.
Wolterton Hall is set to host two concerts featuring renowned ensembles. The Gesualdo 6 will perform on May the 17th, offering a blend of Renaissance polyphony and contemporary works, including a new piece by Tony Britton. Hannah Perrone and Synchronicity Chamber Collective will take the stage on August the 8th, with a programme celebrating Vivaldi's lesser-known violin concertos and works by his contemporaries. The Gesualdo 6's one-night-only concert promises an intimate experience for classical music lovers, with the group known for the intricate beauty of their performances. The Synchronicity Chamber Collective's concert, titled Vivaldi and the Violin, Not the Four Seasons, will highlight a selection of Vivaldi's 230 violin concertos, most of which were composed during his time working as maestro of music at the Ospedale della Pietà in Venice. The concert will also feature the renowned Devil's Trill Sonata by Giuseppe Tartini. Norfolk Church's Trust members can enjoy a 20% discount for both concerts using the code NCT20 at checkout.
A Singing for Health charity is celebrating its 10th anniversary. Playing for Cake, based in Sheringham, is holding a community concert on Thursday, May the 22nd. The celebrations will be held at the Sanctuary at St Andrew's Methodist Church, with doors opening at 1:30 p.m. The event is part of the Creative Sheringham Festival. The group provides community singing groups for people across Norfolk and Waveney. Groups will share personal stories about how singing has supported their well-being.
Model railway enthusiasts are set to gather for a special bank holiday display. The Broadland Model Railway Club is hosting the event at Stalham on Sunday, May the 24th. The show promises to transport visitors to different railway worlds with an array of model train layouts on display, including both guest and club exhibits. It is at the Stalham Poppy Centre in Recreation Road from 10 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. Notable guest layouts include Stal East, an O-gauge model based on Stalham. Inglesby Yard depicts a 15-inch gauge line serving the goods yard on the Inglesby estate. Mardling Morking Transport Museum showcases a variety of vehicles integrated into a model railway, all within just 4 feet of space. The Rampage Sci-Fi Model Railway winner of the Best Layout in Norwich 2026 promises a future world where robots and trains interact in an action-packed display. Other club layouts include Cleapoint Haven, Hampstall Green and Herrington. The event will also feature the Loco Doctor, who will be on hand to assess any problematic models visitors might bring with them. For those looking to expand their collections, pre-owned books and models will be available for purchase, along with food and drinks. The club, which regularly brings together railway enthusiasts to build, operate and converse, is also looking to recruit new members during the show. Further details can be found on the Broadland Model Railway Club website.
Maghrebi, Norwich's first dedicated North African catering business, will bring the flavours of Algeria, Tunisia and Morocco to the Roxham Barnes Food and Drink Market on Sunday, May the 24th, and to the Goat Shed Independent Market each month from June until the end of August. The business was founded by Manel Bouzertier. I started Maghrebi because I wanted to share the food I grew up eating, dishes made with love that tell the story of North Africa. The 25-year-old who lives in Norwich said, "Every Sunday, my Algerian grandmother would make us her famous couscous. All I do with Maghrebi is in her memory because she inspires me so much and taught me most of what I know about cooking Algerian food." Maghrebi's debut at the Norwich Global Village Christmas Market in December proved so popular that several items sold out on the first day. Since then, it's expanded to include home delivery, private catering and supper clubs. In April 2026, Maghrebi hosted its first vegan supper club at River Green Restaurant in Trouz. Diners enjoyed a four-course evening featuring authentic Tunisian couscous and handmade gazelle horns, with guests describing it as unlike anything they'd experienced in Norwich before. This summer's market menu features handmade batbouts, mini stuffed Moroccan breads, cardamom and rose buns, traditional North African pastries and mint tea, with most items vegan-friendly. Maghrebi also offers private catering for occasions across Norfolk, from weddings to corporate events. All dishes are made from scratch, using seasonal ingredients. Orders can be placed via the Maghrebi website and social media platforms.
Stoddy Lodge Gardens is opening its spring displays to the public for a special charity event. The North Norfolk Gardens, known for their 200 varieties of rhododendrons and azaleas, will welcome visitors on Thursday, May the 28th. During the day, the Norfolk Churches Trust will serve homemade teas, with all proceeds going to the charity. Spanning 14 acres, the gardens include the renowned 4-acre Azalea Water Gardens, believed to be the largest single planting of Azalea mollis in the UK. Visitors can also enjoy the herbaceous borders, woodland walks, and the scents of magnolias, camellias, late daffodils and bluebells. The gardens will be open from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Tickets are £10 per person, with parking included. Tickets can be booked in advance on ticketsource.com or purchased on the day. Cromer and Sheringham Operatic and Dramatic Society is set to bring its production of Beauty and the Beast to Cromer Pier this month, showcasing some extraordinary costumes. Owner of D&S Costumes, Dan Smith, has been working hard to create an original set of costumes for this production. On top of designing and making the costumes, he will also play Lumiere, the Candelabra. Mr. Smith has also managed to find time to design video wall graphics for the production. The classic story features unique characters who have been transformed into teapots, clocks, plates and cutlery, all portrayed by the Society's 40-strong company. The production will also feature a live orchestra. Beauty and the Beast has a run of 10 performances from May the 23rd to May the 30th, with matinees and early evening performances scheduled to allow children to enjoy the show. Tickets can be purchased from the Pier Box Office on 01263 512 495 or online at www.cromapier.co.uk.
A new Bell Tent glamping site with a bespoke sauna has opened in a tucked away corner of the Norfolk Broads. Wonderwild, situated in the grounds of Wood Bastwick Estate, is away from the main river, with its own secluded broad, where customers can enjoy everything from a sauna with a beautiful backdrop to wild swimming. It is run by Lauren Willimott and Marcella Lamb, who have spent the past 3 months building the calm and relaxing space. This hidden site is just beautiful, and it's a place where people can come to escape the fast pace of everyday life and reset, Mrs. Willimott said. It's also a great place for couples to stay, but equally as great for groups and families, as the Bell Tents can have up to 3 pull-out beds. Day trips to the secluded site are also available, and people can book in for a sauna session for £15 and a wild swimming session for £8. Both sessions include free parking on site and access to the kitchen hub, where visitors can help themselves to tea or coffee throughout their visit. For those who want to make a night of it, During midweek, a direct field tent will cost from £130 per night and £155 a night on Fridays and Saturdays. The platform tents are priced slightly higher at £150 for midweek stays and £175 during weekends. All of the fully furnished tents come with outdoor seating, fire pits and a hanging grill, so guests can cook by the fire or equally can use the communal kitchen facilities. The camping spot is now taking bookings, and in May, guests will only be able to book for up to one night, although this policy is set to change shortly after. We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where an experienced cowgirl looks at farming, we explore some interesting Korean tea facts, look at some record-breaking creatures in the natural world, and consider the friends and foe among the smaller critters who surround us.
Nicola Chester, an ex-farmer, wrote this article for the RSPB magazine in 2024. Being a farmer is all I've ever wanted. From managing my toy Britain's carpet farm a little too long into my teens, to applying to agricultural college and bonding with my future husband over the same farming goals. Despite both working on farms at different points, we've yet to realise our dream. It's challenging, hard work, and complex. I've always lived around the farmed landscape. I love it with a deep but desperate passion because there was always something missing. Something I couldn't quite get a handle on. There were barely any women farming. And the wildlife that had evolved with our farming practices was vanishing. I could see it in myself and I'm still watching it happen. We know how to stop and yet somehow can't. Studying conservation wasn't an option when I applied, but never made it, to ag college. I went to Canada to become a cowgirl instead. Conservation was a side option in game and wildlife management, but I was told in 1989 there were no subsequent jobs for girls and no course in farming and wildlife. More's the pity, because the 2023 State of Nature report shows farmland birds have suffered and continue to suffer the biggest decline overall since 1970. But, as I said, farming is hard. It's all-consuming, and often a labour of love, land and family ties, all done under the duress of unexpected change, weather policy, governments, disease, consumer and market demands. Farmer bashing doesn't get anybody anywhere. It's horribly divisive, and it's often unjust and deeply unkind. Frustrated and grief-struck with loss and a perception of easy fixes, I've been guilty of this, especially when faced with an entire farm's worth of field margins buzzing with insects and bird life, mown pointlessly at the heady height of early summer. I've seen it all, but I've also seen change for good. Farmer clusters supporting each other on landscape-scale conservation projects, sharing knowledge and passion, and bringing incredible numbers of wild birds back. Farmers opting to plant wild bird seed mixes, nectar strips, making beetle banks, and cutting hedges less often, and feeding birds from seed hoppers on a grand scale during the hungry gap. This sort of change is exciting, it's exhilarating, it's doable. Earlier this year, a gap in hedgerow protection legislation from the government was met with around 90% of farmers saying that of course they wouldn't begin cutting hedges in spring just because they could, because of the birds. We demand so much of our farmers, but they're key to saving us, our precious wildlife, the soils, habitats and invertebrates that make farming happen too. It should be a joint contract of will between us, with policy and support, both financial and public, to do what's right. It can be done. Perhaps I gave up too soon on my quest to be a farmer, but we mustn't give up on supporting farmers and wildlife.
Jonathan Nunn, editor of Victuals and London Feeds Itself, wrote this article for the V&A magazine in the winter of 2022. If the history of black tea demands a wide-angle lens, taking in colonialism, war and global trade on its journey to becoming the world's most widely consumed beverage, green tea requires a closer zoom following its spread from China to Korea and Japan, and its indelible effects on the region's ceramics. It is one of the simplest teas to produce, requiring just a short heat treatment after picking to keep the leaves unoxidized, rather than letting them dry and brown in the air, like blanching herbs to retain their vivid green. Unoxidized tea has been drunk in southern China for millennia, but it was during the Tang Dynasty, 618 to 907, that the cultivation, processing and preparation of green tea became a skilled practice and art with its own set of protocols, says London-based tea merchant Timothy Dauphay. Raw leaves were steamed and compressed into cakes for later use, or drunk as an infusion with salt, cloves or fruit peel. Buddhist monks travelling to study in Tang-era China returned to Korea evangelising about the new drink. The twin effects of caffeine, a stimulant, and theanine, a relaxant, found almost exclusively in tea, made it ideal for long periods of meditation. Tea plants and seeds brought to Korea flourished near mountainside monasteries, particularly around Jirsan, in the south. In wider society, tea became a replacement for alcoholic drinks, as it would for British factory workers in the 18th and 19th centuries. The Goryeo era, 918 to 1392, Port Yi Gu Bo wrote, "By the seventh cup, the aroma transports me. With this, I have perfect joy. What need every day to get drunk?" More elaborate tea preparations emerging in Song Dynasty China, 960 to 1279, dovetailed with ceramic innovations. Green tea ground into a fine powder and whisked into milky froth was shown off to great effect in Celadon ware, ceramic bowls with a glossy pale green-blue glaze. A tradition combining tea and celadon reached its apex in Goryeo-era Korea as more elaborate ways to drink were codified and ever more beautiful bowls from which to do so were crafted. Ceremonies were multisensory, with aroma, taste, colour and texture working in harmony. During the Joseon Dynasty 1392 to 1910, Neo-Confucianism supplanted Buddhism, and Korean tea drinking declined, but its ceramic legacy continued. After Japan's late 16th century invasion, skilled Korean potters were forced to work in the imperial homeland, where Korai Chawan Korean tea bowls were prized. Some wares now considered Japanese, such as Mishima and Karatsu, were first produced by these immigrants, and it has been suggested by Tanaka Chojiro, Some wares now considered Japanese, such as Mishima and Karatsu, were first produced by these immigrants, and it has been suggested that Tanaka Chojiro, 1916 to 89, a close collaborator of Sen no Rikyu, 1522 to 91, who codified the Japanese tea ceremony, may have been descended from them. White-flecked, frothy green tea evolved into matcha, now found in lattes globally. Korea tea and celadon ware might be entwined with the larger tea cultures of China and Japan, but are something unique with their own shape. Today, loose green leaf tea, nok chai, range from Ujion and Sejak, which use younger leaves and prioritise unami and fresh bursts of salinity, to nutty, biscuity, Jungjak and Daijak. These shared elements of fired Chinese and steamed Japanese teas, but are completely of themselves oxidised and semi-oxidised, Baliyacha, find no exact analogue in Chinese tea traditions. Perhaps the only thing uniting them with the frothy tea of the Goryeo era is that they all look beautiful when drunk out of a celadon bowl.
David Chapman wrote this article for the Caravan and Motorhome Club in May-June 2026. This issue we look at the UK's wildlife record breakers, those creatures that are remarkable. Let's kick off with the smallest. There is a tie between the goldcrest and firecrest for Britain's smallest bird, both of which weigh in at 5 to 7 grams and have wingspans of 14 to 15 centimetres. The firecrest, a stunningly attractive bird sporting olive green wings and a bright orange or yellow crown, has recorded some amazing statistics. According to the British Trust for Ornithology, its population in the UK has increased by almost 3,000% since 1995, and its breeding range by 935%. In real terms, it has never been common, but there are now more than 2,000 breeding pairs spread over England and Wales. The goldcrest has always been much more common. Our smallest land mammal is the pygmy shrew, which weighs about 4 grams. Due to its very high metabolic rate, it forages throughout the year and needs to eat more than its own body weight every day. Imagine doing that. Shrews have a short life expectancy. Most live to just 2 to 4 months old. The largest. Our largest land mammal is the red deer, with stags standing about 1.3 metres to the shoulder and weighing in at up to 190 kilograms. Defining the largest bird in the UK is more complicated. The white-tailed eagle has the longest wingspan, about 2.4 metres. This bird once became extinct in the UK, but it has been successfully reintroduced first to the Western Isles of Scotland and now also on the Isle of Wight. The tallest bird is the appropriately named common crane, which stands 120 centimetres tall. Hunted to extinction in the UK, it has partly re-established itself naturally in East Anglia, and more recently has also been reintroduced in Somerset. Finally, the heaviest is the great bustard, weighing about 8.1 kilograms. This is another bird that we hunted to extinction, but which has been reintroduced this time to Salisbury Plain. The longest lived of British butterflies is the brimstone. Emerging as an adult in late summer, it hibernates through winter, lays eggs the following spring, and might survive into the summer, giving it an adult lifespan of almost a year. The longest lived bird ever recorded in the UK was a Manx shearwater. It was ringed on Bardsey Island in 1957, when it was thought to be at least 5 years old. It was then recovered again in 2008, at which point it must have been at least 55 years old. Other very old birds include a fulmar on Orkney, which was at least 50. Seabirds tend to live longer than other birds because they are less prone to predation and can move vast distances in search of food. They have evolved to lay a relatively small number of eggs, often only one every year, and show a lot of parental care. The fastest. Being a British record holder is impressive, but the UK has one species which holds arguably the most significant world record. The peregrine falcon is the fastest living creature on the planet. According to Guinness World Records, one particular peregrine falcon was recorded flying at 240 miles per hour after being released from an aeroplane at a height of 3 miles. The peregrine dived directly downwards, a stoop, as it would when surprising and attacking prey. The peregrine is specially adapted for speed. As well as its super streamlined shape, it has tubercles in its nostrils, which break the flow of air and prevent lung damage. We are lucky to be able to see these incredible birds nesting on cliffs and tall buildings around the UK. The longest beak. Butterflies have a long proboscis to drink nectar from tubular flowers, and birds have evolved specially shaped beaks to feed in various ways, as noted by Charles Darwin in his study of finches in the Galapagos. The British bird with the longest beak has changed over time. Until recently, it was the curlew. Its beak is adapted so it can probe deep into mud to find worms. Females' beaks can measure 15 centimetres long. Over the last couple of decades, we have seen the arrival of the spoonbill as a breeding bird in Britain. Its bill can be up to 17 centimetres long. So there we have it, the fast, the small, the heavy, the tall. With all this variety, there is always something very special to see on a walk through the British countryside.
David Lindo wrote this article for the RSPB magazine in the summer and autumn of 2024. The word pest and its use have always troubled me. The other day I was idly staring out of my front window when I noticed a white van parked outside. Inscribed on the side was the name of the company and a proclamation intimating that they can eradicate all pests. When I researched the company online, I learnt that they eradicated unwanted insect infestations as well as removing pest birds in consultation with the local council. I was slightly perturbed as their blurb gave the impression that all beasts with six or more legs can be viewed as pests and fair game if they occur in situations where they shouldn't and in greater numbers than is comfortable. Don't get me wrong, an infestation of cockroaches or bed bugs or a nest of wasps or an army of ants making themselves at home in the kitchen can be deeply distressing. I have been there on all those counts, but you have to ask yourself why these creatures have accumulated there in the first place. Is it a deliberate invasion? Pest is a very human-centric word, indicating a plant or animal detrimental to humans or human concerns. If animals could speak, I would think that they would consider us as pests. All these creatures have a role to play within the web of life. For example, I have a particular dislike for cockroaches. They make my skin crawl. And I'm also not a massive fan of mosquitoes. The sight, sound, and the effects after being bitten by mosquitoes are experiences shared by nearly everyone on the planet. Yet unbelievably, the primary reason for their existence is to pollinate flowers, as well as to provide ample food for many of our insectivorous birds, including the nationally declining swift. Cockroaches are natural recyclers, eating practically everything that they come across. Of course, not everything in nature is lovely and fluffy. Animals such as horseflies, also so important as pollinators, do have a habit of inflicting painful bites. However, it is hard to see what functions bedbugs have in the natural world, other than to suck blood. Regardless, perhaps these are the things that we need to learn to live with. Maybe we have to take the rough with the smooth. We as communities can help ourselves lessen the chances for large gatherings of these animals unduly affecting our lives. We can learn to be a lot tidier for starters. Try not to leave food fragments lying on the floor and in other crevices. This is an open invitation to many of the insect families that I have already mentioned. If you are prone to reacting to mosquito bites, wear light-coloured clothing, wear less perfume and more repellent, and try to avoid boggy areas where they are abundant. This links me back to the biggest picture. We need to halt the advance of climate change, which is causing mosquitoes, ticks, and other unsavoury critters to advance further north of their natural regions. We also have to encourage the growth in population of these creatures' natural predators, the birds, bats, and other animals that feed upon them. Those solutions seem very simple, but they are proving to be the toughest test humankind has faced since the dawn of time, and we are failing. Change comes in small steps, and we can all take collective steps. This summer, as difficult as it will be, we have to try to love, or at least tolerate more, the creatures that we label as bothersome. Importantly, we also need to create more habitat, no matter how small, for their predators to thrive. Let me know how you get on. And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles centre around fundraising and other community matters.
A fundraising book seeking real-life stories has been announced to support the East Anglian Air Ambulance. The public is invited to contribute stories of inspiration for an upcoming book. Submissions can be emailed to eaaabook@gmail.com with book as the subject line. For full guidelines and details of how to submit a story, visit eaaabook.co.uk. The deadline for entries is June the 30th, 2026. And also, a charity fundraiser is lacing up his boots for a challenge along the coast. Christian Lyons, 43, is taking part in the Pier 2 Pier Norfolk Walk on the Norfolk Coastal Path in support of East Anglia's Children's Hospices each on June the 6th. The 32-mile route starts in Cromer and finishes in Great Yarmouth, Mr. Lyons' hometown. To make a donation, visit East Anglia's Children's Hospices website.
Sheringham has had its fair trade status renewed for another 3 years by the Fair Trade Foundation. To maintain its status, businesses and individuals are encouraged to stock and buy fair trade products, such as bananas, tea, coffee and chocolate. Barbara George and Jean Parton, members of Fair Trade for Sheringham, said, "We are deeply indebted to Brenda Smith, a member of St Andrew's Methodist Church, who first ensured Sheringham is a fair trade town. St Andrew's Methodist Church holds stocks of fair trade goods and would bring a fair trade stall to an event you may be involved in, within Sheringham or nearby, to raise awareness of the movement. Fair Trade is also joining A Million Acts of Hope, which includes donating a single fair trade item to local food banks, supporting the people who grow our food, and those in the UK who need it most. This initiative has been launched this week, but this is expected to be ongoing throughout the year."
A fundraising event has raised nearly £9,000 to improve playground facilities for children. The Rock and Run Runathon took place at Reefham High School and was organised by the Friends of Reefham Primary School. Almost the entire school took part, with children completing sponsored laps around the athletics track in a lively, music-filled atmosphere. Rose Levine, one of the event's organisers, said, "This was everything a community event should be. The children gave it their absolute all, and the atmosphere throughout the morning was incredible. What made the day so special was seeing the whole community come together around something that genuinely matters for children." The event was supported by more than 20 local businesses, whose sponsorship covered costs such as T-shirts and medals, ensuring all funds raised by the pupils would go towards the playground project. Former England rugby internationals Ben Youngs and Tom Youngs attended the event, encouraging runners and meeting children. "The funds will help upgrade playground facilities and create greater opportunities for active, imaginative and inclusive play at the school."
Saunders Coaches is making timetable improvements to local bus services in North Norfolk that will come into place from May the 24th. The changes are being made in particular to meet the changing travel needs of local young people following the announcement that Sheringham Sixth Form will close at the end of the academic year. The new timetable includes more evening 55B buses between Norwich, Spixworth and North Walsham, and new evening CH2 buses between Cromer, Munsley and North Walsham. Passengers will also benefit from a new 9 timetable with more frequent buses and earlier morning journeys, as well as more buses along the coast on CH1. To benefit students, there will be better connections from the Cromer and Sheringham area to sixth forms at Reefham and Fakenham. A spokesman for Saunders Coaches said, "These improvements are being made to act upon customer feedback and meet changes in travel needs in our area, in particular catering for changing needs of students affected by the closure of Sheringham Sixth Form."
An inquest into the death of 89-year-old Sheila Hands opened at Norfolk Coroner's Court on Tuesday, May the 5th. It heard Ms. Hands died at Oakwood's care home in Fakenham on April the 18th. Her cause of death was listed as intracranial hematoma due to a witnessed fall. Other contributory factors were also highlighted, including frailty, old age and collateral cancer. The court heard that Ms. Hands was born on November the 12th, 1936 in Wolverhampton. Her address was given as Sheringham Road in Weybourne near Holt, and her occupation as a teacher, although she was retired at the time of death. Area Coroner Joanna Thompson adjourned the inquest to take place on May the 13th, with the hearing scheduled to last 30 minutes. The Coroner's Court Support Service helps bereaved families and witnesses attending Norfolk Coroner's Court. If you are bereaved or have a family member or a witness, please get in touch by calling 0300 111 2141 or emailing helpline@ccss.org.uk.
CPR is crucial to know, but a skill nobody hopes they need to use, let alone on their own parents. But Sally Theodore from North Walsham found herself in that devastating position when she had to use it on her father, John, who had a sudden heart attack at home. She arrived just 5 minutes after her mother Hazel had called 999 and performed CPR for 10 minutes until the paramedics and East Anglia Air Ambulance crew arrived. They continued their efforts to save him for another 45 minutes, but sadly he died. And for Miss Theodore, this was just 12 days before she was set to deliver a pre-arranged CPR training session to her Wide Awake Club on May the 8th in North Walsham, which she opened up to all to take part. This is a support group she founded more than a year ago for people living with fibromyalgia, ME, and similar long-term chronic conditions. However, despite her grief, she said she is determined to go ahead with the session to share in her own words what those moments were like and why having that training mattered. Also, she is now opening the session to the wider community with the hope that more people are able to attend and ultimately act in those critical first minutes of a cardiac arrest. Miss Theodore said, "My main purpose is to highlight how important it is to learn CPR and the importance to be able to step in and try." Until December, she worked for EAAA, which provided her own CPR training. "I am so grateful to the Air Ambulance for training, and I know I did my best," she added. She described her father as amazing, always filled with humour, and an amazing granddad. The family have set up a tribute page to John, where family members and friends are encouraged to share their memories and photos of him, and where they can donate to the EAAA. So online, johntheodore.muchloved.com/. Broad's boaters are calling for a modernisation of how they pay toll fees amid concerns some users are being priced out. A group of owners want to see monthly payments replace the current annual lump sum people pay the Broads Authority to use the waterways. The Broads Reform Action Group, BRAG, say changes to the system would reduce strain on boaters and reduce avoidable administrative pressure for the authority itself. In modern life, monthly payment options are now widely accepted as the norm, including for many recurring public and household obligations, said Karen Morris, BRAG's chairwoman. People can pay council tax monthly, vehicle tax can be spread, and countless other essential payments are structured in a way that reflects how people actually manage their finances in a modern world. From April the 1st each year, boaters pay an annual fee to use their boat on the Broads. The money raised is used to fund the maintenance of waterways. A spokesman for the BA said members are annually consulted on the level of tolls and any changes to the system. This includes the Navigation Committee, which represents boat owners and toll payers. The last consultation on potential changes to how toll fees were paid took place in June 2023, but the spokesman added, "The impact on cash flow and the administration of missed payments was likely to have an impact on the overall costs paid by toll payers." John Packman, the outgoing chief executive of the authority, said earlier this month, "Toll fee dodgers are placing extra pressure on its resources." Miss Harris, however, believes a new system could reduce the demand placed on BA staff chasing payments. She added, "A fair monthly payment option would reduce strain on boaters and reduce avoidable administrative pressure for the authority itself."
Watchdogs from the Care Quality Commission, CQC, criticised long working hours for staff at Westwood Care Home in Sheringham and said residents were at an increased risk of harm and inappropriate care. However, care home bosses said they strongly disagreed with the assessment, were committed to the highest quality of care and wanted to be re-inspected as soon as possible. Inspectors have just published their report following a visit to the North Norfolk home in Westwood Road before Christmas. The home, run by Avery Healthcare, opened in 2024 to provide care for up to 70 people, both young and older. 30 people were receiving care when the inspectors visited. Inspectors gave the home an overall rating of inadequate, as well as inadequate in the categories of safety and leadership. It was graded as requiring improvement for care responsiveness and effectiveness. Inspectors said, "We identified four breaches of the legal regulations." They added, gaps and errors in care plans, risk assessments, and daily records put people at increased risk of harm and inappropriate care. Inspectors did say the provider made sure people could access the care, support, and treatment they needed and supported people to plan for important life changes. A Westwood Care Home spokesperson said, "We take all feedback from the CQC extremely seriously. However, on this occasion, we strongly disagree with their assessment of our home. Nevertheless, we remain committed to continuous improvement and to ensuring the highest standards of care for our residents. Since the inspection, we have strengthened our governance and oversight through the introduction of an electronic incident management system and an electronic audit platform." They said a new home manager had been recruited and new company-wide dementia strategy launched.
Our last few articles cover some significant planning projects and considerations in the local area.
Gavin Payne has launched a fight against North Norfolk District Council after he was refused permission to demolish 8 garages in North Walsham to make way for 5 new containers. The proposal had sparked several concerns from neighbours, including fears over asbestos, and one objector wondering whether the site, off Nelson Road, would become a mini-industrial estate. Following a site visit, the council's planning committee debated the matter at a meeting last month. It was noted that 7 garages had already been demolished and 2 of the containers have been placed, with Councillor Kate Leith raising concerns over the work that has taken place. She said in the meeting, "It seems unfair that the residents I represent should have their lives blighted by this development." However, Mr. Payne argued that it was not about overdevelopment, but about improvement, tidying the site and putting the land to responsible use. The committee then decided to vote against the plans at a meeting last month, rejecting the officer's recommendation to approve them. Now Mr. Payne has appealed his case to the Planning Inspectorate, a government body which rules over planning disputes. In an appeal statement, he said that he was led to believe that there was a good chance of gaining permission with the planning officer supporting the bid. He added that he expected the officer's professional judgment to outweigh the opinions of the committee members who were possibly influenced by others. The replacement of 8 derelict structures with 5 well-maintained shipping containers would reduce visual blight, improve safety, and make more efficient use of the land, he said. These benefits do not appear to have been given appropriate weight in the decision. A planning inspector will review the case in due course.
More than 150 objectors have attacked plans to build a chicken mega farm on the edge of a Norfolk town. E.F. Harold, which farms around Aylsham, hopes to build 4 poultry houses on land off the street in Alton near Causton to produce around 1.36 million chickens a year. The farm argued that this is a strategic investment to secure the future of the business, which has been operating in Norfolk for more than 50 years. But those living nearby have slammed the proposal, claiming it poses a significant threat. So far, 157 objections have been lodged against the plans, with several concerns, such as the impact of unbearable odours on neighbours and increased traffic on the local road network, being aired. One comment said, "The cumulative effect of air pollution, particularly toxic dust and ammonia, poses a significant threat. The proximity of the proposed poultry shed, housing 180,000 birds, to residential properties will inevitably result in unbearable odours and negatively impact the quality of life for those living nearby." Another said, "My primary concerns stem from past experiences living near poultry units where the inescapable odours and animal welfare issues were significant and detrimental. This is compounded by the area's existing road infrastructure, which is unsuitable for the anticipated heavy lorry traffic. Norfolk County Council Highways Authority has also objected to the bid after deciding that the farm has failed to demonstrate that the intensified HGV movements would not have an unacceptable impact on road safety. The company submitted the plans for the site at Docking Farm to Broadland Council. It includes new feed bins, service buildings, access improvements, and drainage infrastructure. The four buildings are set to house around 45,000 broiler chickens each, amounting to 180,000 birds per production cycle. It is then hoped that the development will operate with approximately 7.6 flocks per year, producing an estimated 1.36 million birds annually. The council will make a decision in due course.
Plans for nearly 2,000 new homes on the edge of a Norfolk market town have hit further opposition, with an MP calling for them to be rejected. Jerome Mayhew, Conservative MP for Broadland and Fakenham, said the North Walsham West Urban Extension risks the safety of the public because of the extra traffic it would create. The Conservative MP has added his voice to opposition against the 1,850 home scheme proposed between Cromer Road and Norwich Road. Landowners and a consortium comprising of Flagship Housing, Lovell Partnerships and Land Promoters ESCO Prospect submitted the plans for the scheme, including the first phase of 437 homes, with North Norfolk District Council last month. They are also seeking outline permission for the majority of the site, including provision of elderly care accommodation, land for a primary school, and a local centre for commercial and community uses. People have raised a string of concerns about whether schools, doctors, and roads will be able to cope, with Mr. Mayhew particularly concerned about traffic. In his letter to North Norfolk District Council raising his objection, Mr. Mayhew said it was on the grounds that insufficient weight had been given to the risk to public safety on the B1150 road through Coltishall and Horsted. Mr. Mayhew said the B1150 is the main route through the villages and already carries more than 100,000 vehicles, including HGVs, each week, which he said would increase further if the homes go ahead. He said traffic congestion on the B1150 has also led to emergency vehicles, including ambulances, being significantly delayed. These safety issues are expected to worsen as the planned housing development in North Walsham are projected to increase the town's population by more than 40%, resulting in substantially higher traffic numbers. Mr. Mayhew added, "There appears to be a lack of sufficient funding for road safety measures to assist with the intentions to increase local housing numbers within the North Walsham allocation of the local plan." In documents lodged with the application, the developers, who are planning a new link road connecting Norwich Road with Cromer Road, state, "The proposed development includes a phased package of sustainable transport and highway measures to provide safe access and fully mitigate impacts. The assessment demonstrates that mitigation is deliverable, residual impacts are not severe, and any remaining effects are outweighed by the development's significant benefits. North Norfolk District Council's Planning Committee is due to discuss the plans in the autumn."
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk. We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Daniel Butterworth. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!